Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin.
You're watching Consider This, the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. 1.5 years into the COVID-19 pandemic, Singapore is shifting gears now and is preparing to live with COVID-19 as an endemic virus. Three ministers who co-head the government's COVID-19 task force have said that they are drawing up a roadmap for a different approach to deal with the pandemic, as it is becoming increasingly apparent that eliminating COVID-19 from the world may not be possible. So tonight on the show, we're going to be learning more about how Singapore plans to live with an endemic COVID-19. Joining us now, we have Hannah Clapham. She's an assistant professor at the Saw Swee Hock School of Public Health at the National University of Singapore. Hannah, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. Can I begin our conversation, Hannah, with getting you to elaborate a little bit about what Singapore understands or Singaporeans understand at the moment in terms of the plan to live with endemic COVID-19. What is the Singaporean approach?
Yeah, thanks very much for asking the question like that, because I think we're seeing a range of approaches around the world as to what live with endemic COVID kind of might mean now and will mean kind of in the future. What we're seeing in Singapore is quite a shift from kind of how we've been dealing with things up until now. So previously the approach had very much hinged upon keeping transmission as low as possible. It wasn't necessarily, the sort of zero COVID approach we saw in some places, but it really was keeping transmission very, very low. So we saw very strict border controls with quarantine in place and testing and actually more recently kind of an almost halting of people entering the country. And then within the country, we have a lockdown about a year ago now. It's very hard to keep track. But since then, we have had measures in place. So we've had restrictions on group sizes. Restaurants have been closed and opened again at various times. So we've really seen a sort of an approach that has been aiming to keep transmission as low as possible. And what that has actually meant has kind of changed and calibrated over time. But the real emphasis has been on minimizing transmission. The reason that the sort of shift that we're seeing now in Singapore towards endemic COVID has come about essentially because of vaccination. So what we're seeing now is with vaccination, and we're not there yet, but we're kind of heading towards this with Singapore recently having a big supply arrive of vaccine and that getting very quickly rolled out into the population. We're seeing a shift from worrying about transmission and the case numbers that we're seeing towards a shift where we're thinking about, okay, we're more concerned about severe cases. We're more concerned about deaths and minimizing that. And the reason we're able to do that is because of vaccination, because vaccination means that most people who get infected will not have severe outcomes and they will not die.
Hannah, if I could just step back a little bit and part a reflection on a statement made by our vaccine minister about scale. And, he sort of jokingly referred to Singapore as postage size. Now, the reason I ask this is, are the lessons from Singapore something that the rest of the world, countries of a very different scale, and India and America and Malaysia, can learn from? Or is there something that's unique about the city-state and its ability to control things that has shaped the Singaporean response?
Yeah, I think this is a great question and sort of speaks, I think, more widely to also thinking about, okay, if we see things happening in other countries with regards to vaccination or their response, how much can we learn as a country? How much can Singapore learn from other places? How much can other places learn from Singapore? And a really important point. I think one of the big advantages Singapore has had now, and we didn't have this up until very recently, was that we do have this supply of vaccine, and that unfortunately is a thing that not every country is currently in the same situation that we are in, a situation that we've been able to open up the vaccination to everybody in the population, and everybody who wants to get vaccinated can. As regards to size of the country, I think the important thing when we think about that with vaccination is Singapore of able to look at the population as a whole with regards to vaccination coverage. They're able to say, okay, we have in the population 60% coverage, 70% coverage, you know, hopefully we're heading higher than that in the coming weeks and months. In other places, the national level of vaccination might be less informative about what's going on and what transmission would look like in different places, and they might need to start looking at within cities or within regions what is the vaccination coverage, and therefore what does that mean for our control and what we could expect in terms of cases and what other measures would kind of need to be in place.
Right. Hannah, can I just ask you, I mean, it's been, I think, about a week or so now that the health minister, the people on the COVID-19 task force had written that op-ed about living in an endemic COVID-19 society. Can I ask how the buy-in has been so far from Singaporeans? Has there been a buy-in by society at large about living with COVID? That means doing away with the daily case numbers that, you know, for 18 months we've been so fixated on, and living with testing, with wide testing. Is that something that Singapore's accept?
I think we'll see kind of as things roll out. I think at the moment, the sort of the slightly abstract nature of, you know, things will be changing and they'll be changing in this way. You know, I think in general, people are, as I think we're seeing globally, you know, want to move on from living under these strict measures and want to be able to kind of move on with that. And, you know, that's hopefully will be possible. And as I said, with the vaccination will become increasingly possible. I think testing is an important point that you raise. And that's something that has kind of been coming into Singapore more recently. So we, you know, rapid tests are now available in the pharmacies. I bought mine a couple of weeks ago, and I think we are, you know, there has been suggestion that perhaps we'll be moving to using those more. I think that will be an interesting sort of point as to how acceptable that is and where they're being used, and, you know, how people who are vaccinated or not kind of come into that. So I think that will be an important point kind of moving forward as we look to that testing as to how people accept it and are willing to use it.
Anna, what's also quite surprising about the Singaporean scenario as it's developed is that in the early days, there were a very high number of infections, but very low deaths. And I think the death rate remains low. Correct me if I'm wrong. What accounts for the fact that the deaths are resulting from COVID-19, the disease, have been relatively low in Singapore?
Yeah, so when you kind of look on this aggregate level, yeah, you're absolutely right. In terms of the numbers of infections and cases that we've detected, the numbers that have died have been very low. I think there's two main reasons for that. One is that Singapore has been doing a lot of finding very, very mild cases. So, you know, we have this very extensive tracing system. And so people, if they're known to be a contact of a case, you know, are put in quarantine. And then if they develop any sort of mild symptoms, might get a test. And actually now I think a lot of there's testing happening even without symptoms. So the kind of reported numbers of infections and cases is perhaps capturing a much, much milder case definition than it is in other places. So that would mean that per infection court, we kind of would expect to see fewer deaths. I think the other big thing that we, unfortunately, that happened in Singapore was that we saw a huge amount of transmission happen in the migrant worker dormitories. And this is a population that it does is generally younger than the wider population. And so we saw a lot of infections, again, capturing very mild infections. But even without that, we would have expected to not see sort of as many deaths and as many severe cases in that population because they do skew younger. I guess the final thing to say on that is that there was also, you know, excellent care. We never reached a point in Singapore where the healthcare system was overwhelmed. And there was a lot of care, you know, treatment given or you know, medical attention paid to people at that mild stage, and, you know, were able to continue to get the care if they developed onto severe disease.
Hannah, the idea for living with endemic COVID-19 also means travel will resume, borders will reopen, and a different thinking when it comes to that mandatory quarantine that countries around the world have put in place. Can I ask you, you know, if this is Singapore's plan, Singapore being part of, you know, the wider world. How does that kind of public health approach fit in with the rest of the world, particularly with countries like Malaysia, who are still right in the thick of things in dealing with the pandemic?
Yeah, so this will, I think, have to be thought about very, very carefully. So I think we will not sort of immediately see this sort of opening up of travel as going from sort of, as I said, very, very little now to completely kind of free. So we'll probably see a few sort of stages along the way. I think, as you say, you know, infection rates in other places might play into that, though there could be some argument that, you know, once we are a very highly vaccinated population in Singapore, we could withstand a little bit more of infection coming in from outside in terms of, but that would have to be very carefully calibrated and kind of about as we go through. So that might mean, you know, a shorter quarantine. I think no quarantine. I think the other thing that would factor into this is vaccination of people coming in. And then also we have the testing that we spoke about. So we might see scenarios when we move towards people as they come in having to do more tests rather than have to quarantine for those periods of time. But this is all sort of, I think, things that are being discussed and will be, you know, changing as things.
Hannah, do you think that, you know, the whole question of variants of the virus will change the outlook? You know, the question of endemic COVID and policies related to it don't seem to have been, you know, seem to come out just at the time when the Delta variant was being discussed globally as well. So how does those two things come together?
Yeah, I think this is a really important point. And I think, you know, we saw that previously the measures that were in place in Singapore essentially managed to kind of keep it in some ways out. And if it did come in, we didn't see these wider transmission going on. That did seem to change with the Delta variant. So with studies going on around the world and what we're kind of seeing now, we do seem to see that Delta variant is more transmissible. And so that means that the sort of the calculations perhaps that we're thinking about in terms of what it takes to control it and the what that means in terms of the societal impact of controlling it, that calculations perhaps now changed a little bit. So it is, I think it has been an important sort of factor in when we're seeing it. And I think we're seeing this globally as countries that maybe, you know, had brought transmission under control with a combination of vaccine and other measures. Now with sort of Delta coming in, are having to slightly reassess either the measures that they have in place or kind of what they expect transmission to look like in the coming weeks and months.
Right. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, but Hannah, please stay on the line. We'd love to continue this conversation. Still a lot to cover about Singapore's response to Singapore's new approach to the pandemic. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. Hi, thanks for staying with Sharad and I on Consider This. Let's continue our conversation with Hannah Clapham from the Saw Swee Hock School of Public Health at NUS in Singapore. Hannah, I want to come back to comment a target set by the Singapore government of having 2/3 of the Singaporean population fully vaccinated by August 9th, by National Day, essentially. And I'm just wondering, within the month time period at the moment, what are some of the stumbling blocks still that perhaps you're watching out for in terms of reaching this target?
Yeah, so this is a great targets that have been set. I just to sort of start off, I think, you know, that's not the end target. Hopefully we'll keep climbing beyond that, but that's a nice sort of intermediate target that we're heading for. So as I said initially, I think we did have some supply issues that meant that was could not have happened, but those have been resolved, which is great. And so, you know, there are now, it would seem, a wide range of a wide number of vaccines that people can have. So I think there's a couple of things that we'll be sort of looking out for and seeing. I think, you know, people that I'm speaking to, lots of people do really want to get the vaccine, and that's great, and they're able to get it. You know, if people still have concerns, we need to make sure that their concerns are being listened to, and that they're able to kind of ask the questions of the things that they're worried about, you know, in terms of the vaccine. But in general, people do seem to be sort of comfortable with getting the vaccine, which is great, which they should be, because they're safe and effective. I guess sort of in terms of logistics, as we move into this like working age population, which is what we're really seeing now, and a mass vaccination, you know, employers are having to think about letting people have time off in order to get vaccines, making sure that, you know, if people do have the mild side effects that we're seeing with the vaccine, that they do are able to allow people to time off for that, or to ensure that they're fully staffed and those kind of things. So I think we are seeing consideration of that, which is great. And then I think the other really important thing we need to watch out in that 75% is that's an overall population. We're looking at 75% and that's great. But there are a few sort of key populations that we do need to be thinking about within that. So particularly the older age group, which we have seen some hesitancy in getting vaccinated in Singapore in that age group. So I think it's a case of you know, making sure that if anyone has any questions answered, that they are answered, and that we're able to give them the information. And it might not be completely hesitancy. You know, there might be access issues and those kind of things. And we have seen changes over time with now home visits with vaccination, and just making sure that we really understand what are the barriers to people getting vaccinated, and that we're able to provide solutions for those.
Hannah, you know, the mantra used to be that the best vaccine was the vaccine you got in your arm, right? Or whatever that was available. That seems to be shifting, partly because even the nature of vaccine nationalism in the West, that in many ways is shaping the conversation, has changed. So could you help us understand, you know, why Singapore chose Pfizer and Moderna over what now seems to be a smorgasbord of vaccines? And Cuba just announced very successful trials on their vaccine, and so on and so forth. So why Pfizer, Moderna? And then that whole Sinovac question, which we could come to later.
Sure. Yeah, so, I mean, I think there was a whole lot of discussion and negotiation that went on sort of at the very, very high levels in every country's government, essentially, in order to secure the vaccine that they were getting. So that's sort of, in a lot of places, that's now what we're seeing, is we're seeing the results of those negotiations happen, and those are the vaccines that have been available in the country. So for Singapore, that was initially Pfizer, and now we're seeing Moderna coming in. Each country then also has their own kind of approval process and decision to make about how to use the vaccines that they're getting, and how that fits in with their kind of overall aim of their program. And so each country, you know, has the ones that they've negotiated that they're able to supply to the population. And then we're seeing around the world kind of different decisions being made about who those vaccines go to, depending on a whole range of criteria. So I think this is another thing that, you know, we can learn from other countries, and we can kind of look at what other countries are doing. But there are a lot of sort of very specific country reasons why we'll see different vaccines being used in different places.
All right. Can I follow up then, Sharad's question about Sinovac? Because, you know, there was a statement made by the Health Ministry, the Singapore Health Ministry, not too long ago, that said that, well, you know, doctors are required to tell patients receiving vaccines, Sinovac vaccines, that they may not be regarded in the same manner as those vaccinated with the government-approved Pfizer or Moderna vaccines. Can you explain a little bit what the thinking was behind that?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, sort of when the vaccines that are available to a country, then there's a process of kind of deciding sort of how to use those vaccines. And so Singapore has its sort of own process that goes on in order to make those decisions. And I don't know exactly what's kind of going on in those discussions, but it would seem that that group are not yet happy with the information that they've been getting from Sinovac for whatever reason, in order to be able to kind of put them in the main program. But we have seen this kind of availability of Sinovac sort of coming in other ways, as you mentioned. And so that does lead to a slight inconsistency and a slight difficulty as we kind of move forward. So that will have to be very carefully thought about, I think, as we see, you know, people who wanted the Sinovac for whatever reason, can they also get Moderna or Pfizer? What are the kind of calculations that are going on there? So I think that will be an important part kind of moving forward as we see highly vaccinated population.
Yeah, Hannah, because there's the public policy issues related to it and privileges or access, you know, differential privilege and access. I mean, from a public health point of view, is it wise, is it ethical, is it fair to discriminate between vaccines in a population when it's not simply a question of the individual's choice, right? What was made available to them, for instance, to kind of impose differential access and privileges.
Yeah, and I think generally this is a really important point as we sort of start to move to where perhaps people who are vaccinated will be treated differently for travel or for things within a population. How does that work with the different vaccines that are out there, either within a country or across countries? As we've discussed, we'll be seeing different vaccines being used in different places. I think the reason that we're seeing this in Singapore right now is that the Sinovac is not part of that approved program. So, you know, There are a small minority of people who did have some allergic reaction to the Pfizer and the Moderna, and they have been advised to get Sinovac for health reasons. Other people who are choosing to get Sinovac are not doing that for necessarily health reasons. They're taking a decision that they would prefer to be having that vaccine. And the kind of message that from the Singapore government is our program is supplying these kind of other two vaccines, and these are the ones that we're currently putting in these measures, and that we understand what they are doing and how that fits in with our overall program. I think there is also a point to be made about the sort of the fairness of these measures. And I do think that as these measures start to come in different countries, it is tough and perhaps unfair to be bringing these measures in where everyone has not had access to the vaccine for whatever reason. You know, we saw in Singapore, it's only very recently opened up to foreigners under the age of 40, for example. And if measures had been brought in earlier, then that would have left a large group that would have not sort of been able to get a vaccine and would have been left out of these measures. But as we move to the point where everybody has had access to the vaccines and the possibility to make an appointment, get those vaccines, have the time to develop immune response, that's the point at which we will probably start to see much wider of these kind of policies where vaccinated people can do certain things and non-vaccinated perhaps have to take different precautions in those situations.
Right. In the couple of minutes that we have left, I just wanted to ask you, because the Singapore Health Minister has said, you know, if I may quote him, saying that, you know, COVID-19 is a shape-shifting enemy and will continue to throw curveballs in this plan to live with an endemic COVID-19. I'm just wondering, from a public health policy point of view, from a scientific point of view, what are some of the curveballs that you are concerned about, particularly when it comes to blind spots when, you know, in policy making?
You know, we are looking forward and we're optimistic to what can be happening in the kind of future, but we do always have to have that sort of concerned hat on, what could happen with this and what are we kind of looking out for. So I think a couple of things that we sort of don't know at the moment, because for a variety of reasons. One is the sort of longevity of the vaccine and how long the protection from the vaccine lasts. Just because these vaccines have only been given a certain period of time, so we just haven't had the time to kind of observe that and see that. And so that's be something that we'll be monitoring very carefully, and will be monitored around the world sort of as to how well do these vaccines continue to protect, and if we start to see things of concern, what do boosters look like, you know, those kind of things. I think kind of related to that, there is, of course, the issue of future variants. As we said, the Delta variant did seem to be quite a game changer in what we saw. And we, you know, do have concerns about what could happen in the future. And again, that's a case of kind of very good surveillance for what variants are circulating globally and which ones are circulating within each country as they kind of start to look at those things. I think, you know, we talk about treating COVID as this kind of endemic pathogen, perhaps similar to other endemic pathogens, and we do hope that with vaccination that will become true. But we do also have to bear in mind that this is something that we haven't seen in the world for, you know, we've only had it for a year and a half, and we do have to perhaps have those additional measures in place to just be keeping to look out for what could be happening, and we can think very carefully about what those should be.
Right. Hannah, thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight and speaking and sharing some of your insights and the perspectives from Singapore. Appreciate your time. That's all we have for you on this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching the show, and good night.